This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. And it is Valentine's Day weekend. And we just can't leave well enough alone. So last month, we hired a design firm to overhaul the holiday. And we also gave listeners a challenge to present your ideas for a radical Valentine makeover. You submitted nearly 200 designs, so thanks. And to judge those entries, we've enlisted somebody who knows all about modern love, the writer Elizabeth Gilbert. She is the author of the best-selling memoir Eat, Pray, Love, and she's just come out with a follow-up called Committed, A Skeptic Makes Peace with Marriage. She's here with me now, Elizabeth Gilbert. Welcome to Studio 360.
Thanks. Great to be here.
So it is Elizabeth Gilbert weekend. It's Valentine's weekend.
Oh my God! Is that my weekend now?
Well, I think if you're gonna claim any holiday as yours, it has to be that. Do you have a position on the official love holiday?
Oh wow! Well, you know what? It's interesting because I was doing a little research in preparation for this, and it was curious for me to discover that it wasn't until the mid 19th century that the whole practice of giving and receiving Valentines happened in America. And that's really curious because I just wrote this book about marriage, and it wasn't really until the mid-19th century that the whole practice of getting married for love came into being,
right,
or that the mass market of romance kind of happened in America. So it all seemed to happen around the same time, a time that has to do with the Industrial Revolution and the invention of the middle class and the fact that people had the luxury to be able to choose partners based on love instead of on pragmatism. So it seems like you could sort of say that romance was invented in the middle of the 19th century.
So I guess if you've accommodated yourself to marriage, you have to accommodate yourself to Valentine's Day as well, is what you're saying.
I guess so. You know, personally, I guess because I grew up in this really pragmatic Yankee family where there was, you know, it was always said that it was the greeting card seller's holiday.
Yes, I had the same family.
it never was a huge thing in my life. I remember my dad coming home from work, and he would have stopped at the equivalent in those days of Walmart, although we didn't have it yet, and picked up some saran wrap flowers, and he would walk in and throw them on the table to my mother and say, "There," you know, which is about as romantic as
how
things
sweet.
Got. Don't say I never got you any flowers. And she would dutifully arrange them and you know, make the best of it. But no, it's not really a holiday that's ever been very dear to my heart.
You've been a nonfiction writer, journalist for some years before you published this gigantically successful memoir. As you were thinking about your next book, which Committed is, did you ever seriously consider making it something other than the next chapter in your life story?
No. Actually, to be honest, I was working on a novel when my husband got detained, arrested, and deported by the Homeland Security Department. And all of my attention was going into the novel. And then obviously this crisis in our lives and the fact that we had to spend almost a year out of the country trying to get him back in took over my attention completely at that point. And also, you know, I had realized in the writing of Eat, Pray, Love that I'm a pretty representative 21st century American woman in terms of the way that I feel, fear, and experience things. And I thought, I can't be the only person who has these questions and these hostilities and these issues to work through. So, you know, once more, let me do what I can do and other people can't do because of the nature of my work, and that is spend 3 years doing absolutely nothing but thinking about this and researching it and talking to everybody that I'm capable of talking it to, and then kind of writing up a book report that I can spread around and give to people and say, "Here, this is what I found out. If it's helpful, have at it."
So thanks to the difficult federal immigration authorities, they put you back on your road to your destiny, I guess.
A most unlikely Cupid was Officer Tom of the Department of Homeland Security, who arrested and handcuffed my sweetheart in front of me and took him away at the Dallas-Fort Worth airport. But indeed, he was the Cupid of this marriage.
And then you married the guy, cutting to the chase. But has that guy or anybody else who was involved at that seminal moment read the book? Gotten in touch with you?
I don't know. I wonder if they'll find themselves or if somebody will bring it to their attention. I would imagine that it will seep into their consciousness somehow. It's a pretty big part of the book, that whole scene that takes place in the Dallas-Fort Worth airport. And the guy was, you know, and this is the weirdest thing that I ever find myself saying, this Homeland Security Department guy was very kind, and actually in a completely surreal twist ended up giving us marital advice when he saw our grim faces of doom after he had sentenced us to wed, and he started asking us what the problem was with it. And we explained that we'd been through divorces and we just didn't have the heart to go through it again. And he was the one who said, listen, you know, think about signing a prenuptial agreement if it's the financial stuff that worries you, or maybe you want to get some counseling. And it was just so bizarre to be sitting in the bowels of the Dallas-Fort Worth airport with this, you know, Texas Homeland Security officer with a paunch kind of wearily giving us advice on how we might do better the second time.
Good comedy scene in the movie version. How much do you think movies and television have affected the way girls and boys and women and men think about love, marriage?
Well, hugely and unquantifiably, I would imagine. You know, Shakespeare said that every tragedy ends with a death and every comedy ends with a marriage. Certainly every romantic comedy ends with a marriage. And it's such a wonderful ending point, you know, from a dramatic point of view and from a screenwriting point of view and a novelistic point of view, you could hardly wish for a better conclusion to the story. It wraps up all the tension and all the ambiguity and everything is settled. And that's wonderful and we need that. And I like those movies and I go see those movies and I enjoy those movies. But the problem is that it sets up, you know, the obvious dilemma of allowing people to believe that the wedding is the end of the story.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, as anybody who's been married for more than 15 minutes knows, it doesn't really help you explain how to cope with the next five decades. There's also the problem that people will spend, you know, so very much more time having conversations with their future spouse about, you know, what color the bridesmaids' dresses are going to be and who's going to sit at what
table. Arguments over the China pattern.
Yeah, rather than having the big three conversation, you know, which are the big three issues that shipwreck
children, sex, and money.
Children, sex, and money. Oh. And if you haven't really settled that stuff, you might want to pause on the conversation about the flower arrangements.
Do you have a favorite romantic film?
Oh, so many.
Well, you can have many.
Oh, you know what it probably is? This is going to mark me as such a girl. It's probably the BBC Pride and Prejudice, that 75-hour-long one that introduced us to Colin Firth in his wet shirt, you know, coming out of the swamps near his house. That would probably be it. In fact, I recently was able to entice my husband to watch the entire thing with me. And he, you know, it's wonderful. It's Jane Austen. It's brilliant. It's witty. It's delightful. It's interesting. So he watched it. But at the end of it, when it was all over, he said, okay, tomorrow night we're watching Braveheart. And the next night we're watching Gladiator because we have to get this out of our system. And so we went from... oh, Mr. Bennett, I certainly could not abide with that to, at the sound of my command, release hell. So it just seemed to be the only fair thing to do to permit him to go on a testosterone bender.
And of
that.
Course, the Jane Austen, again and again, ends with a happy wedding and everything's nicely, tidily buttoned up.
Yeah. It wouldn't be Jane Austen if it didn't have that ending. And Julia Roberts movies and Meg Ryan movies wouldn't be themselves without that.
Now, I don't know if you've sold the movie rights to Committed yet, but you did sell the movie rights to Eat, Pray, Love. And I wondered if that gave you any pause.
You know, I certainly paused before I did it and thought about it. And, you know, I know from experience and my own experience and other people's that when, if you're lucky enough to get the opportunity to get a Hollywood movie deal for your book, the one question that you have to ask yourself is whether you are capable of walking away from it and turning it over to other people's hands and letting them do whatever they wish with it. Because any illusion that you might be offered of having any control over what it becomes is, of course, precisely an illusion. And not even directors necessarily have that much control in big Hollywood movies over the final product. And so that was the question that I had to ask myself. And actually, to be honest, I think it was easier for me to consider doing that with Eat, Pray, Love than with anything I had ever written in the
really?
Past.
Because it's you. It's the intimate details of your life.
I know. You would think it would be the opposite. Yeah. But it's because of what Eat, Pray, Love became and how quickly and swiftly and dramatically it escalated to a point where it wasn't me anymore.
So you're already naked to the world. You might as well go all the way.
Yeah, it already belongs to everybody and people appropriated it already and they've claimed it, you know, for themselves in their own ways. And it really long ago grew past me feeling like it had much to do with me. And so it wasn't a big step to say, well, let it go the extra mile. You want to be a movie? Go be a movie. You're old enough to drive. Like, I didn't know you wanted to be a bestseller. So that was the feeling that I had about it.
And I suppose the idea of Julia Roberts playing one isn't so bad. How does that feel?
It feels precisely how you would think it feels. It's totally.
I've never
totally
thought of her playing
surreal.
Me.
It's completely surreal. And I haven't even really processed that yet. And the thing that's even more surreal is the idea that my husband is going to be played by Javier Bardem, and that I'm going to watch essentially me, the character of me, making out with Javier Bardem. That's the part that I really can't wrap my mind around and also can't wait to see.
Yes. Will that be for you, I wonder, pornographic or anti-pornographic or some weird combination?
I think it will be frighteningly pornographic. But, you know, actually in the end, I feel like it's going to be sort of like a home movie. And it's cool because I didn't take photographs while I was traveling. I'm not visual like that. I don't have any documentary evidence of the places that I went to that year while I was traveling. And they made a big effort with the movie to go back and refilm everything exactly where it happened. And so it's sort of like a home movie, but I've been photoshopped out and somebody so much more attractive has been photoshopped in, and that's kind of great.
Elizabeth Gilbert's new book is called Committed, A Skeptic Makes Peace with Marriage.